Here I am tonight. David Sirita is going to blow your socks off. David Sirita's first aspiration in life was to become an astronaut. In 1968, he and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After that experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, as you might imagine, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since Roswell in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields. He studied world religion, science, physics, and paranormal psychology for over 25 years. So in a moment, and he's really got some audio that will blow your socks off tonight, in a moment, David Sirita. All right, just before I bring David on, Robert in Las Vegas, just over the hill from me, says, "Hey, Art, if you truly believe all of these things you fear," meaning Ed at Dames, "because you see the beginning of the truths all around you, then why did you choose to bring a new child into this doomed world? Shame on you." Well, first of all, I have not seen these things. Ed is the one who has seen these things. What I am acknowledging is that I'm certainly seeing the beginnings, and I don't see how you can not acknowledge that, and that goes for all the rest of you too, that these things he said so many years ago do seem to be around us. But I choose life, and I choose hope, and I guess I have faith, perhaps misplaced as it may be. I have faith in life and love, and what else carries us all on? All right, David Sirita, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
I think I finally saw Pahrump, Nevada. I drove through it on my way out of Death Valley.
No kidding.
Is that your radio tower, the big red tower in the middle of town off the side of the highway?
Well, we have a red tower.
The red tower.
No, not the red one. No. That's a cell tower.
Oh, okay. It was amazing.
We do have a tower. There's a tower as you come into town from the California side. Mm-hmm. That would be KNYE's tower. And then there's one here at my house as well. So towers all over the place. Anyway, David, apparently, let me read this. It says, David Sirita will present a fraction of the total videotaped disclosure of a 72-year-old Boyd Bushman, Lockheed Martin senior researcher scientist of 20 years, program manager, top secret clearance, former employee of Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, General Dynamics, and more. He designed the Red Eye missile, now the Stinger missile, infrared FLIR systems, and most importantly, he claims he reversed, he reverse-engineered anti-gravity and UFO technology. Now, this man is 72 years old presently, is that correct?
73
now.
Yes.
All right. When did you do this videotaping, David?
Well, it was kind of getting near the end of filming for my new movie From Here to Andromeda, which is due out at the end of the month. And it's kind of a surprise. I had been in touch with Boyd Bushman through our friend John Hutchison for about 8 months now. Him and I have been emailing each other, and he's very, very, you know, secretive in the emails and on the phone calls. He just said, "Come to Texas and we'll talk." So finally, we went to Texas about a month ago. We got there and we meet this gentleman, and it's literally, I mean, when you're sitting in his presence, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that this man is beyond Einstein. It really isn't. And from my years of study, I've been around people like Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, Bogdan Castle Maglich, who invented helium-3 fusion, Murray Gell-Mann. The list goes on and on and on. I've been around all of these guys and been able to pick their brains. There is nobody I've ever met who compares to this individual. Boyd.
All right, I guess, David, my first question would be, why would this man at 73 years of age decide now to tell this incredible, I mean, to do this kind of disclosure? What do you think motivated him, his age, or he wants the truth out, or he's, I mean, if what he says and what everybody's going to hear here in a little while is the truth, he's got to be violating all kinds of security oaths and God knows what else.
Well, firstly, remember the statement by Ben Rich, who was former head of Skunk Works at Lockheed? he said to disclosure witnesses that the Air Force has just given us a contract to take E.T. back home in a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base slide presentation in 93. And at an alumni speech in at UCLA in 93, he said, we now have the technology to take E.T. back home. And amongst those statements, he said that we already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. So
Yes. What
we're having here is disclosure on camera of anti-gravity, proof that Roswell was an alien craft and that we shot it down, that these technologies have been, anti-gravity has been reverse engineered since the 50s. In fact, he actually shows documents that we'll go into later. And he actually demonstrates anti-gravity right in front of us, my fiance and I, on camera.
Oh my God.
And how it works is really not that hard to understand. It's not really that difficult. And I believe, to answer your question, the reason why.
Yes.
Think of the pledge of Gary McKinnon, you know, the computer hacker who hacks into the military computers and believes the government is hiding evidence and technology that could save the planet. I mean, environmental zero-point energy technology. And this man really feels that way. I mean, Boyd Bushman really feels that we are probably not going to survive, that we have to potentially go to another planet to transfer the human experience so that it can continue. And right now, if you really look at the headlines and we don't bury our heads in the sand, it's pretty obvious that at least a large portion of us are going to face extinction.
It is ominous, David. There's no question about it. It's ominous, very ominous. I'm very concerned. But again, so you're saying then that Boyd Bushman sat down with you and said that mankind, is at a crunch point. He believes that's what pushed him forward.
I think that's partially what motivated him, but also think of the bell curve, which is that, you know, when technology is discovered and it's tested in research labs and eventually it comes to fruition for humanity, I think they're so far beyond anti-gravity at this point. In fact, he's explicit in describing how far beyond anti-gravity we are, and it's very close to the statement, you know, by Ben Rich, that I think it's time that we have anti-gravity. And the reason is, just think of this logically for a minute. For example, all these new electric cars coming out, like Tesla Motors electric car, and you have this Zap X coming out that does 155 miles an hour and has 350-mile range on one set of batteries. You can recharge them in 4 hours. Now, what would happen? Because he actually demonstrates this in front of me. What would happen if I could cancel out 50% of the gravity on that vehicle? What would happen to the range? I mean, literally 50% of the weight charge in relation to gravity. If I could cancel out even 50% of it, the tires would still be on the ground.
Right, but it'd be very light. I can't do the physics. Sitting here, I can't do the physics. But obviously, David,
it'll probably do 700 miles per charge.
Yeah.
A Hummer could do 35 or 40 miles per gallon. So just that much, just if they give us that much, let alone actually flying, and I think he gives us enough to actually fly, it's going to change everything. I mean, where we spend most of our energy in this quest towards sustainability and getting off foreign oil, which I think all Americans would agree that we need to do, if we can even reduce 25% of the energy we're using, I mean, in shipping, cargo containers, the weight of a cargo container, our motor vehicles, transporting food, I mean, goods, all of it, if we could reduce 25 to 50%, we would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by the same. Now, it's possible to reduce it 100% from what he's actually demonstrating. And I believe that the reason he's doing this is because we will not survive. He knows that we will not survive without it. And there's something else that he discloses in the film interview that is even more shocking than that about our own survival. But firstly, just the ecology, just on a sustainable level, this will change everything.
All right. What about his background, David? It says here, let's see, Lockheed Martin, senior researcher, a scientist, 20 years, program manager, top secret clearance, former employee of Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, General Dynamics, and much more, the Red Eye missile. How much of his background were you able to confirm, David?
All of it. I mean, I went on the U.S. Patent Office, where he has 26 filed patents that are not classified patents, and every single one of them has his name on it. In fact, he has one of the best. Let's just start here. I worked in landmine and bomb detection for a small defense contractor in Irvine, California. for national security, for airport security and landmine detection. And one of his patents is actually probably the best detection system for buried landmines I've ever seen. And it's actually, you know, it has Lockheed Martin's name on it and his name on it. And it's patent number 5,982,180. And it's called Tesla Lightning. He uses a Tesla coil to produce high-voltage sparks. And the sparks go right through the soil and map out. They literally target the metallic detonator on the landmines, and it takes a picture. And then you follow the trails, and you go and you find, you know, whatever the metal thing that is.
That's remarkable.
And it's remarkable that that is not even being used because it's brilliant. In fact, it's better than our system. We were using neutrons to radiate the soil to bounce back gamma signatures in the form of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus. So, yeah, I mean, no matter how many patents I've looked at his on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, they're all there. So we have someone who's, you know, in the process of disclosure. We had, you know, Bob Lazar back in the 1980s. We had astronaut Gordon Cooper testify that he saw UFOs. Major Bob White at Edwards Air Force Base, and when he was test flying the X-15, testified that he saw a UFO right outside of his window. That was in Time magazine.
Wait a minute, David. Does he actually verify what Lazar said?
What he does, there's one point when I asked Boyd Bushman in the interview, because he gives me so much information.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons he picked me is because I'm very close myself in my own research into anti-gravity. In fact, I may have part of the problem solved that they don't have solved, and that's efficiency. But nevertheless, I asked him, does Lockheed have, you know, just like Ben Rich said, do they have this stuff perfected yet? And what he says to me is really peculiar. He says, I've given you the Lazar tapes, because he gave me these Bob Lazar tapes that are ancient. I mean, some of the earliest disclosure he ever made publicly. And he said, the reason I'm giving you those tapes is because they're from a white world form. And in the negative space of that, what he's saying is there's a non-white world form. And then he says, I can't tell you any more than that when I'm probing into Lockheed itself, when I'm actually probing into the company. But when I actually asked him about how does anti-gravity work and do we have it working, that's when he starts doing these little experiments in front of me that are so simple, one step at a time, all on camera. You get to the point that you can amplify them and you can understand how it's happening.
Right, so the first big revelation is the reduction of gravity or anti-gravity, if you will, right?
Okay, the first revolution is this. First, Bob Lazar told us that element 115, which is quite an astounding story, because element 115 at the time he disclosed it did not exist. At the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, or Lawrence Berkeley, one of the two, they finally developed 115, and the formula, if you put them side by side, and there are long math formulas, are almost identical to his. It's really exciting.
I'm seeming to recall that they did, in fact, discover 115, but that it was not stable. Is that correct?
It is not a stable element, but according to Lazar, it is stable. But what Boyd Bushman tells me, they've now developed elements that are far beyond 115, and they do start to stabilize up there, just like Bob Lazar predicted. But 115, at least our version of it, is not stable. No, it exists for a fraction of a second.
Well, by the way, that 115, I learned in an interview not very long ago, is still in somebody's possession.
It is. Yeah. It is. And what Lazar first said, and I really believe Lazar's story is true, in that he did have access and he did have close contact with these, you know, reverse-engineered alien craft, and we'll get into the proof of that later, but his interpretation of what they're doing with 115 initially was that to produce a lot of gravity, if you want to fight gravity, if you want to actually fight it and counter it, you have to have a lot of mass energy equivalent, because mass, gravity, and energy are equivalent in equals mc squared.
Right.
Energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared, and mass and gravity are in the same kind of a relationship. So what Boyd Bushman says to me is, that's not correct. We're not taught. He said there are a lot of scientists that are producing a lot of mass energy formulas to produce a lot of gravity to fight gravity and to move things around. And he said that's not what we're talking about at all. He's talking about the discovery, a radically new discovery of an additional four forces. Now, we have five forces that we know: gravity, magnetism, electromagnetism, which is light waves and radio waves and television, the strong nuclear force, which binds atoms together, which holds everything together, and then the weak force, which is the underlying force. And we have five senses, which is kind of interesting. We have the five physical senses. And we think of the sixth sense being an extension, or an extension beyond the known senses. Boyd points out that the sixth force is not a force that's repelling gravity or fighting it. It's free of gravity, and they call that the expansion force in the universe, which is already identified. That's the force that's causing the galaxies to drift apart or the universe to expand. And it's actually stronger than gravity. So if you can enter that sixth force as an actual material spacecraft, you become free of gravity and inertia, which means you can do high-speed turns. There's no G-forces on high-speed turns. Gravity has no effect on you. And once you reach that place, the energy that it takes to go the speed of light and beyond is tiny, insignificant amounts of energy. So the whole emphasis, and I've been saying this all along, is it's not you don't want to fight inertia. Inertia is both a body in motion and the tendency of a body in motion to resist acceleration, which is, for example, when you stick your head out the window of a car doing 90 miles an hour, your head blows back, right? So the wind, the air has mass, and it's pushing on you. It's producing what pilots call drag. So you can only go so fast through the air mass. And then when you get out of air mass, you get into space, and you think, wow, now that I'm in space, I can go any speed I want. Well, that's actually not true. Space is full of mass. And in fact, you're pushing through a fabric. And the faster you go, if you could even get to one-tenth the speed of light, which is 67 million miles an hour or 186,282 miles per second. Now, if you could go that fast, and all of a sudden there's an asteroid right in front of you and you got to turn right to avoid a collision, the G-forces on the turn are going to kill you.
All right, this resistance in space that you're talking about, David, is this what the scientists or the physicists are calling dark matter?
There's a competition between dark energy and dark matter. And the expansion force actually wins the competition. So gravity is the weaker of the two forces. So now what Boyd Bushman says is they've already discovered force number 6, 7, 8, and 9. And what force 7, 8, see, they anti-gravity they've had since Roswell. And what I'm going to play for the audience is an actual audio clip of Boyd Bushman. Now looking at his credibility and what he's about to say here, is he personally is friends with a Navy doctor who he says, because I knew you were coming, meaning me, he called a friend of his who's a Navy doctor during the time of Roswell. And this particular Navy doctor treated a pilot who actually shot down the Roswell UFO. The question is, with what and how? So can I play the clip or should we do it later?
Just a couple of things that I want to clarify. Does he verify Area 51 in the sense that it was an area where, as Bob Lazar told us all, they were testing alien craft?
Absolutely. I mean, that is affirmative, 100% affirmative. That he, in fact, that was one of the most shocking things he said initially when I asked him about, some of these UFOs people are seeing, are they ours? And he immediately goes into Area 51, which, of course, officially doesn't exist. So here is a Lockheed senior scientist with, top secret clearance who designed the Stinger missile for General Dynamics, and he's moved on to Lockheed for 20 years, and he's telling you that not only does it exist, but because so many people were encroaching in on it, they moved it. And he tells you in the film where they moved it. So it's like he wants us to know this stuff.
All right, now, you're suggesting or you're telling me that he said he knows who shot down the Roswell craft.
Yes, he does. The mystery is the weapon with which, because bullets were only 1,500 miles an hour, and that's the first thing I said is, oh, my God, you couldn't have done it with a bullet, and he just started laughing. No way. There's no way it was a bullet.
Oh, my God is right. All right. Well, we'll find out what it was in a moment. David, stay right where you are. We're at a break point from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I'm Art Bell. Here I am. Well, we're in the middle of a big one here. David Sirita is my guest. And I've just got a couple of more questions. Of course, I want to know how we brought down the Roswell craft. In fact, if we did, and he claims we did and knows the pilot who brought it down and how, we'll find out in a moment. Good morning. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Sirita, and he is about to present to us a testimony of a man, a 72-year-old man, Boyd Bushman, who was a Lockheed Martin senior research scientist for 20 years, program manager, top secret clearance, former employee of Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, General Dynamics, and more. The man who designed the Red Eye missile, now the Stinger missile, infrared FLIR systems, and most importantly, he says he reverse engineered anti-gravity and UFO technology. So we're in the middle of a big one here. David, his demeanor when you were there, it was, you know, I have to ask, I mean, solid and sane and all of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you talk physics with somebody like this, like, I mean, he reminded me of Glenn Seaborg in a lot of ways, his demeanor, the way Seaborg was a very tall man. He was, of course, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, authorizing all the nuclear testing not far from you. And, in fact, Howard Hughes used to complain, Seaborg told me, of the shaking of the casinos and tried to get, you know, them to stop testing nuclear weapons. And when I looked at, you know, Boyd Bushman, it's there was a level of brilliance. In fact, Seaborg actually told me this. He told me this before he died. He said that about gravity generators, he said if anyone was developing a gravity generator, you would have something far beyond nuclear fusion. And he said, I don't believe anyone is doing anything like that yet. And Albert Giorso, which is Seaborg's personal assistant at Berkeley, told me that Seaborg had access to levels above top secret that were at least in the 30s, from what I remember. Now, if Seaborg was saying that, and he didn't know that anti-gravity was being developed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which we also get confirmation from Boyd Bushman, in the 1940s and 50s, you know, just after Roswell, then Seaborg didn't have access to this. He didn't have access to this level of information.
All right, let's come back to the Roswell craft for a moment. We were talking about the fact that he claims to know who shot it down and how it was shot down.
Yes. Now, what are you saying? Now, you have to remember, this is post-World War II. You know, we just dropped the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945. So in 1947, July, you know, we're still living in the post-World War II era. So we see an enemy aircraft in our airspace. We don't know that it's not Hitler. We don't know that it's not somebody, you know, one of our allies or one of our enemies. We don't know. There's no radio contact. And the way he describes this thing is it's spherical. But remember, his friend is a Navy doctor who treated the pilot who shot down the Roswell craft. Because when I play this, you'll understand that. So we have golden testimony from Boyd Bushman and his friend, who today is still a medical doctor and was a Navy doctor, treated the pilot. So the question is, why did he treat the pilot? And I mean, it's really incredible what he's saying here. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. In fact, the fact that an alien craft would be flying in our airspace in a post-World War II environment and not expect to be shot at is quite quite amazing in itself. But then when you think of what could we shoot it down with, because bullets only travel at 1,500 miles an hour. And if you go back to Kenneth Arnold's sighting between Mount Adams and Mount Rainier, he estimated these craft to be doing 1,800 miles an hour. So that's faster than a bullet. So a bullet would never hit anything like that. And then after his sighting, you go to western Idaho. United Airlines pilots see the same chevron-shaped flying saucers in western Idaho. Then in Portland, Oregon, they're seen again on July 4th, Independence Day. They were seen all over the city. So these things are moving all over the country. There is somebody in our airspace that's not supposed to be there. In fact, very recently released FBI FOIA documents on their website, there are numerous accounts of these saucers, even in the eastern seaboard. They're flying all over the country.
All right. All that said, David, how did we shoot it down?
Well, the way we shot it down. Now, when I asked Boyd the question, I said, there's no way it could have been a bullet. He just started laughing. He said, we have all kinds of things out there. But the question is, what did we have in 1943? And the only thing I could find was that when Tesla died on January the 7th, going into the 8th of 1943, very recently released, and I'd never had these when I was director of the Tesla Foundation in L.A., FBI documents clearly state that there was a race to get the Tesla death ray in 1943. In fact, Tesla had a meeting with Roosevelt the next morning, January the 8th, 1943, to talk and discuss the development of the death ray. So, and in fact, the documents state, which I have in my possession, they're kind of like majestic documents on Tesla, that the Tesla death ray was our only possible defense against atomic weapons. And that is what I believe shot it down. The way the death ray works is it fires a ray that disables. It disables all the electronics. That means the spark plugs in the piston engines in the aircraft. I mean, Boyd Bushman is saying that he was flying the fastest aircraft we had at that time, which I think was an F-86 or possibly another experimental aircraft. And it basically shorts out all the electricals. So in the UFO, the same thing, you know, theoretically would happen. You would fire the Tesla death ray at it. In fact, one time, very recently, I just kind of disclosed a little bit of this on a radio show. Someone said that they have a witness who was at Roswell during the time of the crash, and there are certain people that say there were lightning storms certain days of that particular week. Nobody knows the exact day of the Roswell incident. This woman said it was a clear sky, and she saw a bright flash of light in the sky, like a lightning strike, but there were no clouds, and there was no...
No, wait a minute. There were newspaper headlines.
Yeah.
So we can pretty well place the apparent or the alleged day of the crash, can't we?
Well, we have the week. We have July, you know, is it the 1st, the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th? I mean, we have the dates of when Jesse Marcel actually came to the site and led.
That's true. Yep.
We have those dates. So the question is, at the exact time, was there a lightning storm? I've looked very closely on NASA's website of our conventional aircraft receiving lightning strikes, and you know, you get little burn marks on the side of the aircraft, but it doesn't bring them down. So the question is, did lightning bring it down? I mean, when you listen to this testimony, I firmly believe that it was something that was shot down. And the reason I believe that is because when you look on in these FBI documents and you look at the numbers of sightings of these things all over the country in a post-World War II environment, I believe we were tracking these things on radar like crazy. We were following them all over the place. And we didn't get all of them because there were more than one, according to... In fact, on July the 8th, at Edwards Air Force Base, I have copies of testimony from several military officers from that base who saw 9 UFOs, chevron-shaped UFOs, over Edwards Air Force Base. And then there's another document that states, this is on the FBI's website today. It's on their site under FOIA. It's amazing. It's almost the equivalent of what the French just did, except there's no... in fact, it was actually brought to my attention by a fellow researcher, a friend of mine, who said, David, you better look at this. 1,500 pages I have in this file on different levels of, you know, UFO investigation cases under the FBI are there. They're available. And these saucers were all over the country. They were everywhere. So, of course, we were going to chase them and try to shoot them down. And the question was, with what? And I believe, I mean, Boyd just starts laughing. He just says, we have things out there, and he can't identify the weapon for me personally. So when I did my own homework, I really believe the most advanced thing we had back then was the Tesla death ray.
Okay, that comes from you, though.
That comes from me. I mean,
okay.
We can play this.
Now, with regard to the audio you've got of Boyd Bushman, how long is it?
It's just about 2 minutes.
About 2 minutes. All right,
yeah.
Let's go ahead and play it. I wish I had it and I could play it here, but you've got it, so we'll have to suffer along with that.
I
and I think it's going to work. Go ahead and play it.
Okay. Possibly.
Because I knew you were coming, I again got called a friend of mine
mm-hmm.
who was a Navy doctor
mm-hmm.
during the same time period we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly after that, and he all of a sudden was healing a pilot, mm-hmm. a person that had been pilot. And he began to tell him a story, and he basically said, one day I was up in one of the faster airplanes that we had,
mm-hmm.
and I had something that was a spherical object that was ahead of me. And I called back and I said, are there any friendlies over here?
Mm-hmm.
He actually took off from a Texas location. Headed off that way. And
towards New Mexico.
And they said, well, no, there's no friendlies here. And said, not only that, but he's accelerating away from me, and yet I have the fastest airplane that's been designed.
And at that time was...
And therefore, it can't be one of us.
Well, that was...
And he said, well, they said, well, you have the weapon on board. It was a new design.
Oh,
and he said, go on ahead and shoot it down. And so he did.
He shot down the Roswell craft. Do you know who did it?
He said, don't give the people my name, nor
and
give
you know that
nor give, no, you certainly
he shot it down.
He's a very dear the doc.
Wait,
the,
what kind of a
the
weapon?
The doctor is a very dear friend of mine.
What kind of
you got that?
I got it.
Oh, and it goes on, and eventually it gets to the point where the pilot actually sees, and I guess in one of his flybys, he lands his plane, and one of the aliens is out running around somewhere, and the other aliens are actually in their custody or in their...
And he's saying he says all of this?
He says all of it. I mean, this is all in my new film, From Here to Andromeda, for people who want to see the whole thing. There's so much in this film, not only this. I mean, it's a four-hour film, which is really in four parts, like a series. And I go step by step with Boyd Bushman throughout the film, in one, you know, starting with disclosure, starting with where they took the Roswell craft. We go to another statement on, as he's holding up this document, and this is really significant for me because what he does next is he holds up this document very, very, you know, almost in a very humble way, and he doesn't spell it out for me. He holds it up, and, you know, my girlfriend videotapes the document, and I didn't really recognize what it was until I got home and I started editing. But on this document, which is posted on your website right now for people to see, it says Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, WAPF, and it's a photograph of a saucer that was first test flew in 1959 out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And it was nuclear-powered, had a ceiling of 62,000 feet and a range of 3,000 miles, and the contractor is Boeing Convair. Now, when Boyd holds this up, he says, I know the individual who put this together. He actually says that on camera.
And so this was nuclear-powered.
It's nuclear reactor. He actually shows me one step at a time how that nuclear reactor produces anti-gravity, because he does it on a small scale right in front of me, and then they use nuclear power to amplify that particular effect that cancels out gravity. And you think about this. This is 1959. I mean, Senator Barry Goldwater was denied access to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the hangar where they were keeping the alien bodies in the craft by...
Yeah, I know. I've actually heard the audio of that. I presume you have as well.
Yeah, and Curtis LeMay, General Curtis LeMay,
that's
is
right.
The one who denies them access. So if senators can't even get in there, presidents haven't been able even to get access. And here's Boyd Bushman breaking history and confirming by holding up this document and personalizing it.
Yeah, that's I'm looking important. At it right now.
What's that?
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, you're looking at it right now. I mean, that's it. It's the classic saucer shape. What I saw in 1968 in Berkeley, right off the hill from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, was a silver metallic saucer hovering there. And now I think when he's holding that thing up, I'm going, oh, my God, Boeing Convair. In fact, I even remember my friend and I, when we were looking at the saucer with this crowd of people on the street, pretending we could see USA written on it because we were Star Trek fans, and we thought, no, you can't see anything on there. The sun's just shining off of this shimmering steel. And now I'm looking at this diagram that is personalized. It has a person behind it who was verifying that, yes, this was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and this was the first test flights of the reverse-engineered saucer at Roswell, most likely, from 1959. And he just keeps going from there. It just gets deeper and deeper and deeper, the levels of disclosure. So we have a statement by Ben Rich, once again, the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, who says there are two types of UFOs, ours and theirs. Now, That is very confirmed by Boyd Bushman. It's very
all right. And by the way, everybody, if you go to the website, not only can you see this diagram, but if you go down below that, there is a photograph of Boyd Bushman, who looks quite distinguished. And so that's the man, and that's the diagram. Think what you will. There it is. Diameter 40 feet, maximum speed. It's hard to read for me. Mach 1.2, is that correct?
Yeah, Mach 1.2 with a question mark.
Power plant, nuclear reactor, range 3,000 miles, crew of one, ceiling of 62,000 feet. First flight, was that 1959 in the USA?
1959.
Contractor Boeing Convair. Wow.
Yeah.
That certainly would explain a lot, wouldn't it?
It explains so much. And the next thing he does is after he demonstrates anti-gravity and how he discovered it personally and reverse engineered it, he shows me this giant nuclear reactor that is a mock-up amplified version of his mini experiment that he does in front of me with a huge crane being lowered into a classified aircraft. And if you when I zoom in, and I do this in the film, I zoom in once again on the corner where all the data is on the document, and it says Convair. And that was in Texas, where that location, where that was actually being.
Is there any way at all, I know it's a silly question, to verify the authenticity of the document?
Well, I've tried my best to do that. There are no documents like this in existence anywhere in ufology. When I look at all of you know, through Ryan Wood's book, Majestic Eyes Only, all the documents they have, I've looked at numerous documents. In fact, there are other documents that are available that show kind of a disc shape jet engine or jet propulsion engine craft, but those are not nuclear powered. Now, if we consider even the idea of a nuclear reactor producing propulsion or lift, NASA doesn't use nuclear propulsion with the space shuttle. We only use it with certain satellites today. In fact, nuclear propulsion is something that didn't really – you're talking the 1950s here.
I wasn't even aware they were using nuclear power for propulsion per se. I know they use it for power, once something's in orbit on occasion, right? Or in some deep space probes, we've certainly used it for power.
Yeah, we use it for power for what are called ion propulsion drives. And ion propulsion drives essentially electrostatically charge propellant mass fuel, very small amounts of it, to give it more thrust. So you get more power. You can go a lot faster. So we have satellites that can do 35 or 40,000 miles an hour, you know, right up there with meteorites. But we don't have anything to date that, you know, under the description of nuclear propulsion that, you know, starts on the ground and just goes lifting up in the air. I mean, that just doesn't exist. I mean, our satellites take off, I mean, in the payload bay on the space shuttle, they're basically let them go up in the earth, you know, above the atmosphere. We don't have anything that takes off from the ground. Now, I researched EG&G. EG&G was one of the top defense contractors in the country. In fact, when I did bomb detection, we did some business with them. And on their website, when I was working there in 1987, they boasted that they had at the nuclear test site, Nevada test site, nuclear test site rocket station at the Nevada nuclear test site, they had successful nuclear propulsion system tests in 1958 and 1968. There were two tests that they did, and they said they were successful. So, and I thought, what are nuclear propulsion system tests, you know, on ground level? What is that? And I asked Stanton Friedman those kind of questions, and he, you know, he has some information in that area. But as far as how it actually works, how the anti-gravity is working, the nuclear energy part is not the answer itself. It's what you use the nuclear energy for. What is element 115, Bob Lazar's, you know, sacred element 115? How is it used? How does it produce the anti-gravity? And that's
David, hold tight. We're right up against a break. There's so much more to do. Remarkable stuff. David Sirita is my guest. I'm Art Bell. We'll be back.